This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, NATO takes control of Afghanistan and California's prisons reach critical mass. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. We've also got there Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post. Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University, is at member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Thank you all for joining us, and let's start with NATO. NATO took over eastern Afghanistan from the U.S. troops yesterday. They assumed control of the entire country and of 13,000 U.S. troops. And it's a historic move. The U.S. is not generally known for liking to put its troops under the command of anyone else, an international body, another nation. Nat, why do you think this is happening now, and do you think that the U.S. has been kind of dead-ended by being in control of Afghanistan?
Well, I think, Farai, this represents a recognition by the United States that the situation in Afghanistan now needs to move, as one general said, from a point of where military superiority no longer counts to one where nation-building becomes more important. And I think part of nation-building, of course, as I said, this is just a transition. It means that you have to have a different face on the people who are doing the nation building, who are both fighting the Taliban and then at the same time trying to build the infrastructure of Afghanistan. I think there's a general consensus that with NATO now assuming a large part of this mission, that you'll see faces from France, Romania, Spain, Turkey, Norway, you know, Denmark, Greece, Bulgaria, other places, and that perhaps because central to this struggle in Afghanistan is the ethnic conflicts. And so putting something other than just the American face on it has got to be helpful.
Professor Berry?
Well, I agree with that, but quickly, Farai, I must tell you that on the topic of Darfur you talked about 20 years ago, people in the Free South Africa movement, including some of your listeners who were kids then and some adults, helped to get sanctions against South Africa, which helped to crumble apartheid. What's missing in Darfur, after all that's said and done, is we don't have the United States moving for sanctions. Civil society and the protesters are stepping up, but we had partners then in the Congress who, in fact, acted, even if the UN did not. I just want to mention that. On Afghanistan, it's obviously a big mess. The United States is trying to, with this policy of NATO taking over, put a new face on it. It's still going to be a mess anyway. The NATO troops are having problems in southern Afghanistan, which they took over 2 months ago, and there's violence going on there. To defeat the Taliban is going to require more troops. The United States still has the largest number of troops in the contingent there. It's a good thing that NATO is taking more responsibility, but until we get out of Iraq and can send more troops, we can send more troops, other people can, to Afghanistan, I fear that there will still be serious problems there.
Joe, things have been heating up in Afghanistan. You've had, I think, 1,000 people killed in the past few months, and it's really taken a back burner to Iraq in the public consciousness, but that, of course, is where we went first, and Iraq came later. Do you think that this move to transfer control will give new strength to people who are trying to bring peace, or is it still going to be a big muddle?
Well, the truth is I don't see it as a as a big difference from what was the situation the day before yesterday. I think in theory it is significant that the United States would allow its troops to be under the control of something other than the United States. But in practice, we're talking about the troops will still be controlled by an American four-star general, Dan McNeil, if he's approved by the if that appointment is approved by the Senate. And so, as Mary said, most of the troops, or certainly a large portion, at least about half of the troops there, are American troops. It's always been a broad coalition in Afghanistan compared to Iraq, because the fight in Afghanistan was seen by the world as an attack against terrorists, unlike the situation in Iraq. So it's always been a broad coalition, and now you will have at least, presumably, an American general commanding the NATO troops. So in reality, it doesn't really seem like much of a difference to me.
I want to move ahead to a topic that really is another topic about violence, but this time at home. California's prisons are stretched so far beyond capacity that the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, has declared a state of emergency. That means that inmates could be transferred without their consent to out-of-state prisons. You know, this is a situation where it raises a lot of questions. One is questions about America's incarceration rate, which is the highest in the world, and also questions about what rights prisoners have. Some people who are part of families that include prisoners say that prisoners shouldn't be transferred out of state because then it becomes expensive and arduous for the families and the children to go visit them. Other people say, well, if you committed the crime, tough. So I'll put those two issues on the table and, Joe, go back to you. I mean, what does this really mean to declare a state of emergency in a prison system?
Well, I think that certainly to critics of the Schwarzenegger policy, it would indicate a failure of the criminal justice system, and probably a failure in a number of ways that certainly could be looked at. One is the inability to have a criminal justice system that allows people who are not hardcore violent felons to serve long periods of time. In other words, to make that a bit clear, there have been a number of people in California, certainly around the country, who have argued that one reason our prisons are overcrowded is because too many low-level criminals are in jail for a long period of time. And California, of course, is known for its three strikes and you're out law. And under that law, there have been numerous stories about people whose the third strike is a relatively minor nonviolent crime, yet they're
in jail
for a long period
of time. I think a guy stole a pizza once and ended
right,
up
exactly.
in jail
and
for
so that adds to this kind of overcrowding. And the overcrowding just didn't happen suddenly. There have been people in California who've been talking about this for a number of years. It's also worth noting that Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, where a number of these prisoners will be going, and that's obviously a long way from California, is quite happy. He ended up issued a press release basically welcoming these prisoners because it means more money for that state's prison industrial complex.
Professor Berry?
It's a giant sucking sound if it works to places that need jobs for people to have prisoners sent there so that they can get these jobs. But when you look to see who's in the prison system and who's in prison, what that tells you is what the social problems are that exist that are unresolved in a particular place. Sure, they're hardcore criminals, no matter what happened, would be in jail. But the fact that you have a drug problem and you don't have drug treatment facilities for people and people are put in jail. The fact that there is an illegal immigrant problem because you don't have an immigration policy that does anything to solve that problem means you got people in jail. So that when you look at who's in jail, so what Schwarzenegger is doing, he's trying to fix the problem, what's on the surface, all these prisoners. And according to some lawmakers, he's doing it for political reasons because we're coming up on this campaign. But he's way ahead anyway, so I guess he's trying to solidify his lead. So it helps the people who get the jobs in the states where the prisoners go. It doesn't help the families who won't be able to see their relatives. It doesn't help the drug problem. It doesn't help the incarcerating people for a long period of time for low-level offenses. And it doesn't help to solve the immigration problem.
172,000 prisoners in California. I guess, Nat, is this time to really rethink the overall picture of who gets incarcerated and how long for what crimes, or is this?
I think that Mary and Joe have nailed it because the stats show that one in every 136 U.S. Americans in this country are prisoners. One out of every 136 residents. And so, you know, whereas it's right now the governor's problem, it's actually not a governor's problem. I mean, we're talking about California, but this is an American problem. And I think that the fact that crime rates have decreased, have dropped to levels not seen since the 1960s, yet at the same time, you know, we've had an increase in the number of the length of time that people are serving in prison, I think it's grown by 30%. You know, we've got just a time bomb here that just slowly developing more prisoners, or as we said, serving longer times. They're aging. And then there's also the problem that happens when you have people confined in spaces like this, when they don't get adequate health care, then they develop particular kinds of variations of diseases that come right back out into the public. when
AIDS
some
among
over,
them.
AIDS among them and various kinds of diseases where sexually transmitted diseases where you have something over 600,000 people coming back every year. You know, we're just kind of acting like this is not real. And then the governor, I think, you know, by exporting his prisoners to Indiana and Mitch Daniels being happy to receive them, just shows you how much, you know, how we're really not serious about this issue.
So we're treating the incarceration problem, but not the real problem.
Well, here's the thing.
We're trying to treat the incarceration problem.
Sometimes the black community in particular has been criticized for political strategy, saying, why do you spend so much time arguing about prisons and incarceration? Don't you want to focus on good black people who do good things? So how do you, I mean, on a political strategy level, Professor Berry, how do you deal with a topic like this, which has implications of race and class and power, and yet give it its due in a country that isn't always friendly to prison reform issues?
Well, the first thing you do is you say that, yes, I'm interested in good black folk. And I'm one
of
them.
Me too, Mary.
This is a both-and problem, not an either-or problem. And the reason why I'm so concerned about all those black and Latino and other poor folks who are in prison is because for the black community, there are a whole lot of our people. A whole lot of our young people are in this situation. They stay there forever and they get old, as Ned says, but they are men and women, increasingly women, who are in prison, lots of them for offenses where, one, if the conditions were different, they might not have done it, and two, if they did it, like drugs and something, if they had some kind of treatment or some kind of networks, and the community needs to focus on it because there are a lot of things we can do as a community to put a body on some of these people to see to that they don't end up in prison and doing the time because they did the crime. So we focus on it because it's a large part of our existence, which we as a community do not want to ignore. It would be easy to ignore it, but it's big. It's part of our whole lives.
And also various studies have shown that black people who are charged with committing crimes are treated differently, that is to say more harshly, than white people who are charged with similar crimes. I mean, there's been more than one study to that effect.
I'm going to move on to...
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, I was just simply going to say that, to echo what Mary said, is that, you know, we have 54% of the federal prisoners are there for nonviolent offenses, 11% for violent offenses. What that says to me is that as a country, we have a failed drug policy that, you know, and it impacts family structure, it impacts employment opportunities. The key thing that's different about this issue with the prisoners now as opposed to the past is that people are living longer and people are going to stay in prisons for a very long time, and that somebody's got to pay for this. This is fundamentally a potential that's going to wreck state and federal budgets in a very profound way. And so I think the implications, as we try to change the way that the country focuses on it, is we just have to start looking at the bottom lines. What are the long-term implications for having to spend so much more money on prisons as opposed to education and health care?
I have one more topic, and we're going to have to be very brief about this. The L.A. Gay and Lesbian Center launched a controversial ad campaign this week that promotes HIV as a gay disease. Worldwide, it affects more heterosexuals, but in the U.S., men who have sex with men are accounting for about 40% or 50% of the total cases. But one Los Angeles resident, a 40-something woman who is HIV positive, believes the campaign is irresponsible.
It pisses the hell out of me. I'm a 44-year-old woman. I'm a single parent. I have three teenagers. I have a 25-year-old son. What are they going to go around saying, oh, mommy, I can't get infected because only gay men get infected? I don't want that message to go to my children.
So, Professor Berry, is this a positive step, this campaign, reminding people who have same-sex relations, okay, well, you are part of the issue, part of the problem. Don't slack up because the numbers have gotten better overall for gays and lesbians. Or is this completely irresponsible?
You don't want to offend people like the woman, although many of the women who catch HIV, become HIV positive and have AIDS, have caught it from men who have been engaged in same-sex relationships. So there's a connection. But there's widespread barebacking, as they call it, in the gay and lesbian community. Guys who don't use condoms, they don't do anything, and because they're disgusted and sick of worrying about AIDS and worrying about all this stuff. And so I think that the people who are putting out these ads are trying to get these barebackers to understand that this is still a serious problem in the community, but it is using a bludgeon to try to get them to do it. So maybe they ought to rethink the campaign and try to come up with something else.
Joe?
Well, you know, in the late 80s, it was commonly considered to be a gay disease, and health officials moved away and encouraged the country to move away from that type of definition, and I think the country did so successfully, specifically because it is not really a gay disease. And to label it that way in order to have the gay population take it more seriously now, as they once did, it seems to me that health officials are, you know, have a good point when they worry about what this will do to the larger community. Will they now think that it is a gay disease, and so heterosexuals then won't pay as much attention to it as everyone should?
Nat, briefly.
Oh, I just think this is a brilliant campaign. I think this is actually an indication how the country has changed. You would not have done this, as Joe said, in the 80s. But the fact that the gay lesbian community decided that this was the kind of shocking sort of Benetton campaign that's necessary to mobilize people to say, own it and end it, I think it's very empowering. I think it reflects a transition in the way that we see both the gay community and the gay and AIDS. And I don't think it's going to have negative implications. I think that it's widespread understanding that this disease is a part of the human condition. But some communities are more affected than others, and they need to get after it.
All right. Nat Ervin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Joe Davidson at the Washington Post, thank you all for joining us. And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on our roundtable, you can call us at 202-408-3330, or you can send an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us.